Good afternoon. Good afternoon. So far we started off the semester talking about kind of the building blocks of what we called a process. And at that point in time, we first introduced this idea of a thread of kind of a virtual CPU. We also introduced this notion of kind of a virtual memory, which we went into a lot of detail about how that sort of actually is implemented, and talked a bit about files. Then we went into connecting machine and some sort of low-level implementations of how we make our processors sort of memory fast, having already talked about sort of how we virtualize the memory with caching. And now we're kind of revisiting that thing about processes and threads we started with earlier in the semester. So we talked about how to create processes and control them a bit. And then we talked about, threads are more than a thing we have that's a part of a process. We can actually have multiple threads per process, and started working with how do we actually program with that. And last time, we went into more detail about that, especially dealing with cases, which is going to be kind of our main subject, when the way we're running a thread is not just start a thread, let it do its thing, have it finish, but doing some coordination between threads in the middle. And one thing we mentioned with that is, well, we have this kind of reordering of loads and stores that we kind of naively think of. We have two threads running. The way it's going to work is that we're going to kind of do one thing from one thread, one thing from another thread, in the order we see it written in the code. We found out that that's not what happens often, because, well, the compiler doesn't necessarily, write to variables, and especially in the order you write in your code. And the processor doesn't do that too. And in general, we want some way of actually sort of coordinating the threads sort of at a smaller level. And our first tool for that was locks. So locks are a way to have threads take turns doing something. And we learned that locks are kind of an advisory thing. They don't themselves restrict anything. So it's not like a lock, if something is locked, you can't get at it. It's not the right analogy. Kind of it's like, we've decided that, before we do this, we're going to put on this hat, and that's going to say who can do it. And as long as we all agree to do that, only one person can wear a hat at a time, only one person can have a lock at a time, one thread can have a lock at a time, so they'll actually take turns. We also talked about barriers. So something that locks didn't do very well is waiting for a bunch of things to happen. And a common pattern with that is we'd be doing something like a simulation where everyone would compute their part of the simulation, and we needed those results before we moved on. So everyone needs to wait for everyone else, and barriers are precisely a tool to do this and to do it possibly repeatedly, and something that you'll probably use on the upcoming assignment. And then we looked a little bit about locks and started talking about what will probably be our first big subject for today, which is the deadlock problem. That when we have multiple locks, we can often run into situations where by using multiple locks, we end up hanging. And it's not because sort of our use of locks is conceptually doesn't make any sense. There's something going on where we have some circular dependency that arises from our sort of natural use of locks. And we're going to talk about how do we avoid that, or how do we, if it happens, deal with it, and therefore continue using locks and still have our programs not hang all the time. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so some anonymous feedback things. So some people mentioned anonymous feedback that was submitted before we went through locks entirely in lecture. But hey, we didn't cover locks in detail in fall 2022 DSA1 due to things happening at the end of the semester. I think we went into basically full detail. Like when I've taught OS, I've taught more about locks, but it's mostly how do you implement locks, which, I don't think we're missing anything by not covering that, because we're not going to ask about implementation of locks just using locks. I think basically did full detail, so I hope we're okay there. Another anonymous feedback on there are captions on the recordings that I try to add by importing from an automatic captioning system. I don't think these are very useful because they're automatic captions, which don't know vocab terms. But I try to import them, and I did miss some that I thought I had imported because the file names were wrong. And some complimentary feedback. And now let's talk about some questions on anonymous feedback. Okay, so let's talk a little about the quiz. So I made a mistake on the quiz. So this is the prototype for pthread join. And I can't write slides. I made it as if the prototype had a star here. Why did I do that? Probably because I was used to using pthread mutex lock and such, which all take a pointer to the lock. But that's not how pthread join works. It takes the pthread t, not a pointer to a pthread t. And if I were like actually compiling the code, which I should have done, besides just carefully having me and my TAs read over the quiz options, where I was most concerned about making mistakes and like missing the word not somewhere, we probably would have noticed because the compiler would give a warning. And for that reason, I didn't intend to test on what does pthread join take for its first parameter, but I accidentally did that. Because it turned out that the two questions I asked looked like questions you might ask if you were trying to test about that and what would happen. Because what's going to happen? Well, if you don't get a compiler error, if it compiles, then the thread ID you're passing when interpreted as a pthread t is going to be a non-existent thread ID. And what does pthread join do in that case? Well, if you look up in the manual page, it's going to return an error saying that that thread doesn't exist and not modify the thing pointed to. And in that case, for question two, was asking, oh, we call pthread join and we use it to fill in a pointer. If I pass the correct thread ID, that pointer would be filled in with the return value of that thread. But when I pass an incorrect one, pthread join is going to say, that's not a thread, and not touch the pointer. So it would crash. And on question three, if I pass the wrong thread ID, the pthread join, rather than waiting for a thread, is just going to say, nope, no such thread, and do nothing, and not wait for a thread. And the threads could be running after that function returns. I didn't intend to check for this, so I accepted both answers for these. But I think because of how it works, that's actually what would happen. You pass the wrong thread ID, and if you wanted to know it didn't work, you would need to do something like, you know, get the return value of pthread join and check if it's, you know, not equal to zero, which if you read the manual page is what it uses to tell you if it fails. Or more likely, you'll notice that something's wrong because your compiler will tell you, hey, you're passing a pointer where you want something else. Yes. So the question is, by the return value that pthread join fills in, is that the exit status of the thread or the return value the function returns? So threads do not have an exit status like processes do. They just have a return value, which is a pointer value, and that is exactly the return value of the function that runs the thread, assuming that it returns. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yes. My realloc code targeted dest instead of test data. Did I actually do that? That would have been an error in that code. That would have been a bug not listed on the list of possible problems. But yes. Yes, that was meant to be dest data. Yeah. So that is an error in that code, unrelated to the options, but yes, okay. Which somehow Nye didn't notice and my TAs reading that question didn't notice. Okay, but yes, you are correct. So yes, in question four, do I have a blank slide somewhere? No, yes I do. In question four, I wrote new data, equals realloc dest dot, and this was meant to be dest data. I'm guessing that didn't confuse people given what the options were about, but it was an error. Other questions on quiz stuff? So I guess I'll go through a few things on the quiz. So question one, there was a lot of wrong answers on, so I probably should talk about that. So in question one, in the thread in the main function, which was foo in this case, q is a pointer. So we have q that points to an element of this array. And that's what we pass to, that pointer q is what we pass to the thread. So the thread is going to get its arg, which is the same thing as p, and it's going to be a pointer to the same place because we're copying the pointer. We aren't making a pointer to the pointer. We're just copying the pointer. So they both point to that array, and the statement that the question was referring to dereferences that pointer, so it's modifying part of that array, which is stored on the stack that's running, or the function that's running foo. Questions on that scenario? Okay, so then let's talk about quiz 4b and c, also problematic. So for 4b, this is another case where I phrased the question wrong. I asked about could it modify the old allocation. I meant an out-of-date one, but that's not what I wrote precisely. But I was thinking, oh, I was asking about where there would be a problem. And the old allocation is only a problem if it's out of date. Otherwise, it's not. But that's not what I wrote, so I accepted both answers. But the key thing is that if in this question we were asking, oh, what if we do some reallocation of 2add? Well, because of the locking convention that we've told you that all the code follows, that reallocation could happen here, or it could happen down here. It can't happen while we're doing this memcopy stuff, so we don't have to worry about the memcopy getting like kind of a mix. It's either going to get the new one when the new one's valid, or it's going to get the old one before the new one is created. In either case, there's no problem with that scenario. And 4C didn't have a phrasing issue, but still had people confused. So we're saying we're doing these two appends at the same time. And if you looked at the code, the first thing we do is we lock the lock for dest. The second last thing we do is we unlock the lock for dest. So it doesn't seem like there's a way for us to have these two actually run at the same time. They're going to end up taking turns. Questions about that? Yes.
For question four, I put down B because, like, looking in the manual page with realloc, it had a chance to, like, it had a chance to free the pointer that it was given. It just moved to a different location, and it also had the chance to just, like, not doing, like, it, there is a chance that I found that it could just be pointing to invalid memory after a realloc.
So your question is, so you're saying that you selected 4B because you thought we would do the realloc up here. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
And new data and data would now point to invalid memory.
Yes, because the way that realloc, from my understanding of the manual page, which could be wrong, so is that it doesn't necessarily modify the pointer of data. It returns a different pointer, and data may or may not align.
Okay, so the question is because realloc returns a different pointer. So the way our reallocating code, our code to use realloc would generally work is we'd use that return pointer to set data.
Okay.
That was my expectation. I don't know how I could have made that clearer, but that was my expectation because, as you pointed out, that's how realloc works. That's how you use it. Because you, just like you wouldn't write code that, you know, malloc something and doesn't use the return value of malloc. You wouldn't write code that realloc something and doesn't use the return value of realloc.
Right, but my confusion, and this is probably my fault, but my confusion was just that, like, I guess it's a semantic thing. It's just that, like, I just thought about using it in a call rather than, like, actually using it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, I'll need to think about that, but my inclination is just, like, if you said, we malloc this, you wouldn't say, I'm actually doing that if I just called malloc of foo. I'm not mallocing foo. Okay. Other questions? Yeah, but I'll need to think about what to do about, yes, I thought I had a good quiz and therefore didn't spend enough time before going on to slides for later this week. But let's go back to our deadlock case. So when we finished up last time, we had this scenario here. So here I have a function where I'm representing a directory as a hash map with a lock. And I have this function that moves the file from one directory to another by locking both the directories, modifying both hash maps, unlocking both the directories. Most straightforward way of implementing that probably. And it should allow us to move multiple files at the same time as long as they're in unrelated directories. It's probably something we want if we have lots of things that are trying to move files around. And usually, this will just work if we happen to have some overlap. So here I'm moving a file from A to B called foo and a file from B to A called bar. And, you know, even if we have overlap, probably still works. So we might have a case here where we start moving A to B, then we start moving B to A, and it tries to do the locking, but it has to wait a bit. But that's fine. That's exactly what we want. We want locks to make these take turns. We don't want both of these acting on B at the same time and on A at the same time, and it seems like we prevented that. But we have this unlucky scenario where we indeed do prevent them from both acting on A and B at the same time, but the way we do that is that we have thread 1 tries to lock A, thread 2 tries to lock B, and now thread 1 tries to lock B. But it's not going to be able to do that until thread 2 gives up this lock here. And thread 2 tries to lock A, but it's not going to be able to do that until thread 1 gives up this lock here. So it's never going to happen, because the lock function is just going to wait until the lock is given up. So they're both going to wait until the other gives up. The other's never going to give up because the lock function never gives up. We're just going to be sitting here forever. So we're never going to be able to run the rest of the code. And the system is just going to hang. We're going to have two threads trying to move files around that are just going to hang, sit there doing nothing. And we can kind of represent this as this kind of graph representation. That kind of gives us an idea of what's going on. We have thread 1 is waiting for a lock on directory B, but that lock is held by thread 2, which is waiting for a lock on directory A, which is locked by thread 1, and we have this circular dependency. And this existence of this circular dependency is why we have a problem. We call this problem deadlock. And you might say, okay, so to solve this problem, let's just make sure that if we're working on AB, we don't also have anything else working on AB at the same time. Maybe we could have some scheme to do that. And now I have a different circular dependency we could set up, where now we have no two move file operations that have more than one directory in common. We have thread 1 trying to lock B while thread 2 has it locked, and it's trying to lock C while thread 3 has it locked, and it's trying to lock A, which thread 1 has locked. And we have a different circular dependency, and we could just have this happen with a different set of calls. And if we think that the first set is going to be hard to debug, this is going to be even harder, right? Where, you know, I could say, oh, why is my move from A to B hanging? I look for things using A and B. Nope, there's no other things using A and B, because it actually has to involve two other threads for us to figure out why it's hanging. Okay. so questions about our deadlock scenario. So I showed deadlock with locks. Deadlock doesn't just have to happen with locks. So let's say, for example, instead of having a function like malloc, which fails when you run out of memory, we have a function which waits for enough memory to be available. Seems like a reasonable idea. And if I have 2 megabytes of space, I can have these two programs that they should be able to run. They'll get a megabyte, those 2 megabytes in some two chunks, do some calculation with that, free them up. But again, I can have another deadlock scenario here, where if they're interleave exactly right, each of them will have a megabyte allocated, be waiting for the next megabyte, and well, they could get it from the other one, but they're not going to do it. They're just going to wait, because it's an allocator wait. And we can kind of think of this as having dependency graph kind of like this, that you have these two units of a resource, we're both waiting for that resource, but we both have all the resource reserved. No one's, unless someone gives up, we're never going to make progress. Even though, and kind of the annoying thing about deadlocks as far as a class of bugs, you know, often this is what will happen, and everything will look fine. Just very occasionally, the whole thing will hang. And I'll do a third example of deadlocks, sort of a classical thought example, which is also what our lab is about, is this scenario for thinking about resolutions to deadlocks, which is what our lab is going to be about implementing a couple. And in this problem, sort of set up, we have some five philosophers around a table, which are representing our five threads that are going to be probably in a deadlock scenario. And they want to eat some pasta or rice, depending on who you talk to or setting up this problem. And they have 2 chopsticks that are shared between the ones around them. You know, probably not a very good table setup, so we'll see. And the algorithm for doing that is they'll grab the chopstick on their left, the chopstick on their right, eat, then return the chopsticks. So we grab the left chopstick. Let's say everyone's going in lockstep. And we want to grab the right chopstick, and it's not there. And if that's our algorithm, we're just waiting forever for that to be put down. It's never going to happen. So obviously, we could have some various ways of resolving this, and that's the lab tomorrow is going to be about implementing a couple of those. Though I would say, from a practical point of view, if you're actually programming, this kind of deadlock scenario, this is the one that you're going to come up with the most in the real world. And we're going to talk about solutions that, you know, handle like the complicated cases and the less complicated cases. So I talked informally about what this deadlock is. And we can say it informally, it's kind of circular waiting for some resource. And the resource often is a lock. Locks a resource in the sense that like one person can have it at a time and they need it to do an operation, typically because we have a convention that, oh, you don't touch this thing unless you have the lock. So we take turns, like this account. You don't touch it unless you have the lock for the account. And we'll skip that. We can more formally define deadlock by specifying these requirements for deadlock to exist. So one requirement is that we have to have mutual exclusion, that not only do we have some resources, but we have resources that only one thread can have at a time. That if we don't have that property, you know, like let's say we have a file that everyone can write to at the same time, we're never going to have deadlock because no one can wait for anyone else. We can just share the file. We also need to have hold and wait. So you saw that allocator wait case, we had a deadlock. But with malloc, we don't, because when malloc doesn't have enough memory, it doesn't wait for there to be more memory available, it just gives up. We don't have that hold and wait property, that we hold a resource. So with memory, we do hold it, and while we're holding that resource, we wait for another one. That's the important part here, is that with locks, this happens because we can lock one lock and wait for another lock. But if we don't do that, we'll avoid deadlock. We also need to have no preemption of resources. By preemption, I mean taking resources away from someone who has them already. So, for example, with locks, once you have a lock, we're not going to take it away from you until you unlock it. Or with memory, once we allocate some memory for you, usually, we're not going to take that memory away from you until you free it or your program exits. And then we need to have an actual circular wait. So we need to have these properties. We need to have resources that when we have them, no one else can have them. That we're going to have one of these resources and wait for others. And that you can't take these resources away from me until I actually run code to give them up. And then we have a circular dependency. Questions? These sort of more formal requirements. Okay, so let's think about when deadlock is possible here. Let's say I have a linked list, A to B to C to D, to E. So a 5-element linked list. And I have this remove node function. And my question is, which of these, if I run them all together, could have a deadlock? And you should be suspicious that a deadlock can happen because I have three locks I'm acquiring, and that's probably where our deadlock will happen. Give you a minute, you can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what should be possible. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks the correct answer is option A, option B, option C, option D, option E, option F, okay, option G. Okay, so we have a split between D and F. So most people agree that if we do A and B at the same time, we can have a deadlock. And why would that happen? Well, remove node of B is going to lock B. It's going to lock A. Actually, I have this written out here. It's going to lock B, it's going to lock A, and it's going to wait to lock C. Remove C, it's going to lock C, and wait to lock B. So we have sort of our remove B thread. It has locked, it has A and B locked. And our remove of C thread has C locked. And remove B could be waiting for C, while remove C is waiting for B. And there's our circular dependency. We also have another lock of A, which isn't relevant to the deadlock, but does exist. And so that means that scenario A, we can have a deadlock, and scenario C, we can have that deadlock happen, and maybe some other deadlocks, but it's sufficient that that deadlock can still happen if we have another thread doing some other stuff. Just because, you know, in the simplest case, that other thread just gets delayed by being slow until the deadlock starts. So then the question is, why isn't B and D running at the same time a deadlock, as some of you thought that might be? And the reason to think why is because, well, they both have C in common. But that's not going to be enough to create a deadlock. So if we think of our dependencies, we're going to have remove B and remove D, and we're going to have this common dependency on C, and remove D is also going to depend on E. So we have an arrow in some direction for that. And remove A is also going to depend on A. We have an arrow in some direction for that. But no matter how we draw, whether we draw the arrows between C and the arrows between C and remove B and remove D, whether we think they're waiting for the lock or holding the lock, we can't get a circle. There's no cycle. So we can't make that circular dependency happen. Yes, there's a lock in common, but we don't have a cycle. And it makes sense because we only have one thing in common. For a deadlock, we need to have two things in common at some point. Possibly indirectly, but we need some sort of two things in common somehow to make that circle in that graph. With this, we can have arrows pointing both in or both out, but we can't have a cycle. We don't have enough edges to do that between removing B and removing D. Some questions, how I reasoned about that? Okay, so if we looked at deadlock, we looked at these requirements for deadlock, and we can use that to reason about ways we can prevent deadlock. And not all of these are applicable to all scenarios, but yeah, going through each of the requirements. So one of the requirements was mutual exclusion. If we get rid of that mutual exclusion requirement, we have no issue. So for example, if we have enough resources that we never run out. So if we're talking about memory, if we never have to wait for memory, well, if we have infinite memory, we never have to worry about deadlock with memory. You know, if we have infinite copies of things and they're all dependent, like, that's not a problem. If we never have any shared resources, so, you know, if each thread works on a different things, we don't have to worry about deadlock, pretty trivially. They can't be waiting for each other. These are usually not so practical. So maybe a more practical one is not waiting. So if we avoid the whole waiting for resources, we can avoid this issue. So one way of thinking about this is rather than waiting for something, we'll get a busy signal and we'll just give up, maybe try again later, maybe not, but we won't just wait forever. And you might say, well, how do we do this with locks? The lock function just waits. And well, there is a version of the lock for pthread locks, which is just try lock. And there's also a timed lock. So that's options for not just wait. So we can just check if the lock's available. But then the question is, what do we do otherwise? But that's kind of tricky. It's going to depend on our application, whether we have something sensible to do if we can't get the lock. But at least we won't have a deadlock. So we can imagine, like for allocation, our normal malloc doesn't have this problem. And another way we could avoid this hold and wait thing is by doing this other option here of revoking resources or revoking giving them up. So that doesn't seem really viable for locks, but there are ways that for specific applications, you might be able to make that work. And for other resources, you might be able to do it. So if we think about memory, if we want to free up some memory, maybe we could just kill an unimportant program, and now we have memory. Problem solved. So for memory, we can imagine that our solution would be that, you know, rather than having the thread waiting forever for its extra megabyte of memory, we just steal it from some other thread by killing it. Hope that thread wasn't doing anything important. Then no deadlock. Maybe we created another problem, but no deadlock. And we can try these ideas with lock. So I mentioned try lock for the kind of failing approach. We could also implement revocable locks. And the idea would be that we'd have some way of like causing an exception in the thread that had the lock and having it run some cleanup code right away so it would give up that lock for us to use. And some databases do implement this kind of idea. But the way you may implement it safely with locks is you have some way of invoking give up this lock cleanup code so you can, you know, fix that, make it sure that it still makes things be consistent. So that's with sort of giving up, preempting resources. One thing to mention about this idea of try to get it and give up otherwise is often you'll want to do this retrying. So a common idea you might have is we won't have deadlock if rather than acquiring a lock, we try to acquire the lock. If it doesn't work, we unlock everything and then we try again. And the notion for that would be is that I told you deadlock happened because we had this kind of unlucky interleaving. And you might say, well, if we keep trying, that won't keep happening, right? And practically, that's sometimes true. But the problem is that that's not always true. So here, imagine that we try to fix our deadlock in the moveFile function by having this loop which tries to get the second lock. If it doesn't get it, we unlock it, we try again. This doesn't have deadlock. Why doesn't it have deadlock? Because we don't wait for a second hold and wait. We do hold a lock, but we don't wait for another lock while we're holding it, so there's no deadlock here. That doesn't mean this won't hang. So how can this hang? Well, there's no limit on how many times this can happen. We could have our system happen to just keep doing this loop where we try to lock, where both threads lock A and B, and then thread one tries to lock B, finds out it can't. Thread two tries to lock A, finds out it can't. They both unlock it, maybe a little too late, sorry about that. And then they try this again, and the same thing happens because the timing worked out exactly the same way, and this just keeps happening for a very long time. So questions about this kind of how this idea of, oh, let's avoid deadlock by just try and retry, abort and retry, can kind of not work out very well. Okay. And so this kind of scenario does sometimes happen in practice, and it's known as live lock. So it's kind of the opposite of deadlock, but it's another problem where we have hanging, but it's a different kind of hanging. Instead of hanging where everyone's not doing anything, this is hanging where everyone's doing tons of stuff. They just don't make any progress. So if you want to do this abort and retry idea, you have to do something to make sure this live lock thing doesn't happen. And there's some things that real systems sometimes do to do this, like you can try to do some random waiting to make sure that we don't have things precisely in sync, so that hopefully doesn't happen. You can try to detect it, that the threads we've tried a lot of times, and then when that happens, make the threads like take turns with like a big global lock or something like that. There are ways of doing it, but it's extra effort. And this is usually not the solution you're going to see systems use to solve deadlock. That usually, if we think of these approaches here, our solution to deadlock is not going to be any of these, not because we can't do that, but just because they're usually either not practical or to make practical require lots of complicated stuff like handling how do I get rid of locks, how do I avoid live lock, and so on. So I'm going to talk about, I want you to remember the most, our last solution for deadlock, which is, for most applications, what you're going to end up doing, which is acquiring the locks in a consistent order. And this is maybe the most subtle for understanding why does it prevent deadlock. Because this is attacking not mutual exclusion or the hold and wait idea, this is attacking the circular wait. We're going to avoid creating cycles. And how are we going to do it? Well, if we think of that graph, the problem I had is I had someone waiting for a resource while holding another resource, while someone else was waiting for that resource and holding that resource. And this meant that we had different orders in which we use those two resources. That this first thread over here, it acquired this and then this, whereas the other thread that it's deadlocked along with acquired in the opposite order. And that disagreement in order is really what's allowing us to have this circular dependency. So if we always agree that we're going to go, each of those resources in a particular order, we'll never have that cycle. So how can we implement this? So if we think of our move file function, we just need to decide on some tiebreaker between the two things we're locking and always lock in that same order. So in this case, I just arbitrarily chose, I'm going to use the path. Doesn't matter exactly why what I chose, as long as we always agree this is the order. I always lock the alphabetically first path first. And now this means that we can't have that cycle anymore, because if A is before B, I'm always going to lock A first. No matter whether it's move A to B or B to A, I always lock A first. So any order does, we just need to make sure everyone follows the order. So questions on this locking order? So in most practical situations, this is how you're going to actually avoid deadlock. Now, sometimes this might not be a practical solution. So if we go back to our example of the linked list, we kind of needed to lock the node first in order to look at the prev pointer, right? We can't really apply this solution to this case. And if you ask, what would I do if I was implementing a linked list with locks? I'd have one lock for the whole list, unless I had a big reason not to avoid this kind of problem. But this is an example of why, you know, even though this consistent order idea, like, yeah, there's some situations where maybe you can't make it work, but when you can make it work, which is most of the time, it's by far the simplest solution to avoid deadlock. And it's the most common in practice. So for example, in the Linux kernel source code, there are these comments, like here. So there's a comment here saying, oh, we have a bunch of locks in this code. Here's the order you're supposed to acquire them. So this is the documentation of the code, and this is how they avoid deadlocking in the Linux kernel, is that they have agreed that, oh, when this LDT user sem lock gets acquired before mmap sem gets acquired before context lock. And we just make sure all the code follows that ordering. And they have other orderings for other parts of the code. Some questions about our deadlock prevention strategies. Yes?
Could you just quickly go over why it doesn't make sense for
linked lists again? Why didn't it make sense for our linked list example? So with our linked list example, probably the reason we have this lock for every node here is probably meant to make sure no one's changing the prev pointer. So how can we lock using the prev pointer without getting the lock for the node first? So it doesn't seem like we can easily change the order unless we change a lot about how these locks work. That answer your question? So that's preventing deadlock. So another thing we might sometimes want to do is detect deadlock. And you might say, why would we do this? So there's kind of two reasons. So one is if we're debugging or trying to fix deadlock, it's good to know if it happens. We could potentially use the idea of revoking resources from threads if we can detect deadlock. And in fact, some databases do in fact do this. They'll detect deadlock using something like what we'll talk about, and then revoke resources from the threads that are in the deadlock to make progress. Another idea is that we can use this deadlock detection idea to prevent deadlock by seeing if we ran this, would it deadlock? By running our deadlock detection algorithm on the hypothetical, what would it look like if it ran? So how do we detect deadlock? The basic idea is we search for cyclic dependencies. You saw those graphs I made earlier. You need to be able to make those graphs. And then you work through those graphs to figure out, is there a cycle? So if you've learned from some class about finding cycles and graphs, this is a practical application for that. Well, kind of. So conceptually, we'll say thread A, the remove A thread has a lock on B, has a lock, which is remove B is using. We'll have that sort of information, and we can make our graph, and we can just search for a cycle. And if we wanted to implement this practically, we just extend our locks to do the bookkeeping so we can construct that graph. So we can print out, what locks does the thread have? That's just some logging, some bookkeeping. We can do that. Now, this maybe doesn't work so well with divisible resources. So let's say we're doing that allocate or wait idea. So here I have two threads that are trying to allocate 2 megabytes and one thread which has 1 megabyte. This is not a deadlock, even though if we look at the graph here, we have a circular dependency. We have lots of circular dependencies. We have one where this thread depends on each other. We have lots of circular dependencies, but we can't really treat them as circular dependencies because this memory is not like a lock. It's a divisible resource. And we might want some way of figuring out if there's deadlock even in this case. And, well, the justification for why there isn't deadlock is that if thread 3 finishes, then the other threads can make progress. And thread fee has no reason it can't finish, right? It doesn't depend on thread one or two. So this isn't a deadlock, even though it looks like we have a cycle. And we can figure that out by saying, okay, what's going to happen? Thread 3 is going to finish. Then thread 1 can get the memory and finish. Then thread 2 can get the memory once and finish. And we're all set. Versus if we had this scenario, this would be a deadlock. And we can see that here, that we have a deadlock because we have this cyclic dependency and we can't actually resolve this. So how can we tell the difference between this scenario that's not a deadlock and this scenario that is? And the basic algorithm we do is we try to simulate what threads can we finish now. So here, we can't finish any threads now because if I think about, if I gave a thread everything it's waiting for, could it finish? And could I give it everything it's waiting for? The answer is no. There's no thread I can give it everything it's waiting for. So we have a deadlock. That's what we're going to look for. Just check every thread. I say, thread one, can I give it everything it's waiting for? No. Thread two, no. Thread three, no. So that's a deadlock. Versus this scenario, what I'd say is, thread three, can I give it everything it's waiting for? Absolutely. So I just run this and I say, okay, then we can give thread 3. Thread 3 has everything it's waiting for, so it can finish eventually. And eventually when it finishes, I check again. Can I give thread 1 or 2 everything it's waiting for? Yes. And we just simulate what's going to happen as threads can finish. We see, can this thread finish with what the resources it has? If the answer is yes, we eliminate its resources and keep going until hopefully everything looks like it can finish. So this is the kind of the basic algorithm that we track what threads have what resources, we see what resources they're waiting for, we find a thread where all the resources it needs are available, and remove that thread, mark all the resources it has as free, repeat this. And if there's no deadlock, when we do this, every thread will get removed. There is a deadlock, we'll be left with threads that are involved in some cyclic dependency that can't be resolved by, you know, by just waiting for resources, because they're waiting for resources that will never be given up. So this kind of idea of just simulating if all the threads that are running, which ones can finish, and just keep doing that and see if we get rid of all the threads, this is how we can, in general, detect deadlock. And it even works in cases where we have funny cases like, you know, resources where threads reserve like one of three things or two of three things, which don't make sense with where we might have, you know, looks like a cycle, but it depends on whether, you know, you can get half of the resource or not. So questions about this deadlock detection sort of high-level idea? So as an example here, this case is a deadlock, and we figure that out by saying, okay, what threads can finish now? Thread 3 can. I eliminate thread 3. This is free. Now can thread 1 finish? Nope. Thread 1 cannot get its resources. Thread 2 can't. We have a deadlock. Questions? So I'd say, practically speaking, that you're unlikely to actually do deadlock detection, but some things do it. The main reasons why are debugging, or if you have some way of, after you detect a deadlock, doing something useful. And the most common example of a useful thing is like in databases, they tend to say, we're going to abort this operation and try it again later. And that's a solution databases can use for deadlock because they're doing a lot of bookkeeping, so they have enough information to actually abort and retry an operation. For your typical code, you probably aren't going to be happy to set that up because that's a lot of work. But for a database, that can be worthwhile. And databases often do this because when databases are running like SQL queries that people write, it might make sense to acquire locks in all sorts of order, so the consistent order idea is like hard to implement in many databases. Okay, some questions? So that's where I'm gonna leave on deadlocks. I think practically speaking for deadlocks, the big thing to know for actually writing code is this. Just use a consistent order. That is most commonly how you're going to avoid deadlock. There's some situations where that doesn't work, but most commonly that's what you're going to do. And when you're using locks, you think, how am I making sure everyone's consistent about the order in which we use these locks? And if someone's not doing that and you're acquiring multiple locks, you should be very suspicious that there's probably a deadlock. Okay, so with having talked about deadlock, we're going to switch on to a different topic about more synchronization mechanisms. So we talked a lot about locks. We talked a little about barriers. I alluded that we're going to have some much more general synchronization tools. And to talk about those tools, I'm going to go through a very common pattern we see in all sorts of code that tries to coordinate threads, which is a producer-consumer pattern, where we have one or more threads that produce values that are going to go into some queue that and then some other threads are going to consume values from that queue. And in my picture here, I have one thing producing and one thing consuming. But often in practice, we'll have, you know, a bunch of things producing and a bunch of things consuming. And we want them all to work as fast as they can, subject to having values available. And we're going to use this as kind of a running example for looking at some more general synchronization constructs, partly because they'll illustrate how those work, and partly because this is maybe, like, so many cases where you use multiple threads, this is actually what you want to implement. You have a bunch of threads doing different things that need to, you know, when they finish a value, send it to another thread, another set of threads. So the first more general synchronization mechanism we're going to introduce is something called monitors and condition variables. So we're going to have a monitor, which is going to have a lock. We talked about locks for mutual exclusion, but we also need a way to wait for events. So we're going to use a new type of thing called a condition variable. And a condition variable is probably the most poorly named thing we'll come across in this class. A condition variable isn't really a variable. It doesn't hold a value. It holds a queue of threads that are waiting for some event. So the operations we can run on the condition variable are to wait on the queue or to have threads that are waiting on the queue stop waiting. And also, a monitor conceptually consists of that plus the data that is going to be sort of associated with that condition that we're waiting for. That would be part of the monitor. And kind of the original conception of the monitor was the monitor would be like an object like in Java. In fact, Java makes every object have all a condition variable and a lock because they really bought into the monitor idea. And sort of that sort of was the original conception. But we're going to use the pthreads API, which is C, which doesn't have classes, so we're not going to have real objects. We're just going to have mute locks, which are mutexes, and condition variables that we can associate with some data by how we organize our code. And we'll see some examples of that in a bit. But conceptually, a monitor, we're going to have, you know, our lock, our shared data, and our condition variables that are list of threads waiting for things. And we're going to have this lock. And our convention for using this lock is before we access any of the condition variables or the shared data, we're going to acquire the lock. We're never going to touch any of this stuff without having the lock first. So we're always going to take turns manipulating that shared data and adjusting what threads are waiting on those conditions. And because the lock is something threads can wait for, there's going to be a list of threads waiting on the lock. That's just part of how locks work. Threads can wait for them. So there's a list of threads. Maybe it's stored explicitly. Maybe it's not. but we have a list of threads waiting for the lock. And each of these condition variables is going to represent some event we might wait for, and it's going to have a list of threads waiting for that event to be true. Wait, event to happen, I should say. So a condition to be true. And the condition variable is going to have three operations. So one operation is going to be to start waiting. And the way we're going to use that operation is that the current thread is going to be added to the queue. And as part of that happening, we're going to unlock the lock that we had locked already, and therefore let the first thread waiting for the lock go and try to do whatever it wants to do with the shared data. So that's how we start waiting for some event. Now, the question is, how do we stop waiting? Well, some thread is going to change the shared data and realize, oh, this thing you're waiting for, it happened. Or maybe it happened. And it has two ways of dealing with that. So one is this broadcast operation. So this broadcast operation is going to take every thread that was waiting in that list on that condition and make them start waiting for the lock to do something with the shared data. We also have an operation called signal, which is going to choose one of the threads that was waiting. How it chooses it is arbitrary, and make it be able to run waiting for the lock once it gets it. So questions about these condition variable operations and the idea that our condition variables, they aren't really variables, they're just a list of waiting threads. So you can wait to add yourself to the list, and broadcast and signal remove threads from the list and let them run and do something with some data, shared data. In our producer consumer example, that shared data will be the list of things that have been produced. Questions? Yeah.
Can you give an example of shared data?
Can I give an example of shared data? So in our producer consumer example, the shared data will be precisely this buffer. Does that answer your question?
No.
And we'll have another example on the next slide. So let's look at a simple example of usage. So I have two functions here. I have wait for finish and finished. So the idea here is wait for finish will wait until finish is true. And finish will set finish to true, but also do the bookkeeping necessary to stop anyone who was waiting for it to be true from waiting and have them keep going. So how does this work? Well, we have this lock that we're always going to acquire before we touch our shared data or our condition variable. Our shared data in this case is this finished variable. And then in wait for finished, we're going to check if it's finished is already true. And you might say, why are we using a loop? We'll talk about that later. There is a reason I have a loop instead of an if statement. And it is not optional to have a loop. But we'll talk about why later. But we're going to check if it's true. And if it's not true, we're going to add ourselves to the list of threads that are waiting for finished to be true, which is represented by the finished condition variable. So we're going to add ourselves to that list of waiting threads. And by adding ourselves, we're going to give up the lock that we acquired to let other threads go. And hopefully, one of those other threads is going to be down here in finished, or maybe sometime later there will be. But eventually, some thread's going to come along and be running finished. It's going to acquire the lock, and it's going to set finished to true, and then it's going to call con broadcast. What's that going to do? It's going to take everyone who listed themselves as waiting, make them stop waiting. So when they stop waiting, what are they going to do? They're going to acquire the lock again, and then going to check this that whether finish is true, find out it is, and they're going to exit the wait for finish function. So a way this might look is, let's say wait for finish gets called first. It gets the lock. Maybe finish gets called at the same time. It tries to get the lock, but it's going to wait until wait for finish is done doing some stuff. And what's wait for finish going to do? It's going to check if finish is true. It's not. It's going to start waiting. So it's waiting for the condition to be broadcast or signaled to. Then finish thread sets finish to true. Now that it has the lock, why does it get the lock here? Because this gives up the lock temporarily. This cond wait operation, it gives up the lock so other things can manipulate the shared data, hopefully making the thing you're waiting for happen. In this case, that's exactly what happened. The thing we're waiting for is finished to be true. That can't happen until the lock is released. And we want to make sure that, you know, that doesn't happen until we start waiting. So the reason why we want con wait to give up the lock at the same time as waiting is to make sure that there's no way that finished could be manipulated in between when we check it and when we start waiting. And so this scheme prevents that. Right? The only place where finished can be set to true is either before we check it or after we start waiting. There's nothing in between is possible because of the lock. So the finished thread makes the thread be waiting for the lock, and then it gives up the lock, and now that means that the wait for finished thread can finally start running, and it returns from cond wait with the lock, checks the finished value, and now it returns after unlocking. So questions about this timeline here? Okay. So this is probably the most complicated timeline we could have with this. A simpler version might be if finish is called first, wait for finish, we'll get the lock, check if the finish is true, find out it is, and not wait at all. Okay. Other questions about this? Okay, so I had this loop here. I promised I would tell you why there was a loop. So I'm going to do that now. Why is there a loop? Because it seems like, hey, if we start waiting, the only way we're going to stop waiting is when someone calls broadcast or signal. The only call that calls broadcast only does it after setting finish to true. How could it possibly be the case that when we go back to the top of this loop the second time, finish isn't true? Why do I need to check it again? And unfortunately, I do, because I read the manual page for pthread cond wait. And it has this wonderful statement. Spurious wake-ups can occur. What is a spurious wake-up, you might ask? That means that wait returns even though nothing called broadcast or signal. Just could happen. Sorry. So you might say, why did the pthreads people do this? And there's, I think, two reasons. So one is that allowing this makes the implementation of pthread cond wait and broadcast and signal more efficient in the common case. And the second reason is that in more complicated uses of pthread cond wait, you need to double check anyways for other reasons, and we'll see some examples of that later. But because of this, there's no exceptions. There's no case where you don't need to check again. You always need to check the condition because cond wait could randomly just return early. If that's more efficient for the implementation. Some questions? Yes. Okay, so let's look at using monitors to implement producer-consumer. So here I have a buffer, and I have two operations. I have produce and consume. So produce adds something to the buffer, and consume waits for there to be something in the buffer. So we're waiting for an event, which is why I have a condition variable called data ready. We're waiting for there to be data in the buffer. And once there is, it dequeues an item from the buffer and then unlocks. And then finishes. So we have our lock. So we always acquire the lock when doing everything with the buffer. You know, we don't want two threads manipulating the buffer without the lock. They always have to take turns. And it's important that we have this lock. So in between when we check if the buffer is empty and we dequeue something, we know because we have the lock, no other thread's touching the buffer because they would have to get the lock first. And that means we don't have to worry about the queue like throwing an exception, returning null, or crashing, because we know the buffer's not empty, no matter what other threads are doing. And the things we did is we have this con signal here. So when threads are waiting for the buffer to not be empty, you know, we signal one of them. You might say, you know, what if no threads are waiting? That's fine. Pre-thread con signal will just silently do nothing. And that's not going to be a problem, because one of those threads is going to, when it calls consume later on, it's going to check, is the buffer empty? No, it's not, and just not wait at all. And that's fine. Questions? Scenario so far. So let's look at how many times this loop runs. So if we call produce and then we call consume, what's going to happen? Well, produce is going to run. It's going to acquire the lock. It's going to enqueue something. So our buffer has one thing on it. It's going to signal. There's nothing to signal, but that's fine. Nope, not a problem. There's no thread to wake up. And it's going to unlock. Consume, it's going to acquire the lock. It's going to check if it's empty. It's not empty. So it's not going to bother waiting at all. It's just going to dequeue and unlock. So that's our simple case. So this loop runs zero times. We could also have a case where this loop runs one time. We consume is called before we call produce. So what's going to happen? We're going to acquire the lock. It's going to be empty, the buffer, when we check it. And therefore, we're going to call con wait. And that's going to unlock the lock and start waiting. Since we've unlocked the lock, produce can now get the lock. It can add stuff to the buffer. And it can call signal to stop us from waiting. Then when it unlocks, we get to go. And we check, is the buffer empty? Not anymore. We dequeue something. And we return. So questions on this timeline? OK, so I showed how this loop can run zero times, how it can run one time. And I've told you, oh, we can have this thing called spurious wake up, so it runs multiple times, like two or more iterations. There's another reason this loop can run two or more iterations. Let's go through that scenario. This would be an example of that. So here, I call consume, and I figure out, OK, it's empty, so I'm going to wait. Then produce gets called. It acquires the lock. It enqueues a value. It signals us to stop waiting. But while that's happening, another thread comes along and has to get a value from the buffer. And you might say, well, shouldn't that thread wait for us to get a value? That might be a nice idea, but that's not what we've implemented here. So instead, something gets the lock first, and either thread 2 or thread 3 does. And when I talked about locks, locks don't specify in POSIX, pthreads locks, they don't have a specified order. Either of them could get the lock first. There's no guarantees. So let's say we're kind of unlucky and thread 3 gets the lock first. It will dequeue something and get to run, do that dequeuing, before us, who got woken up because this value wasn't queued, get to do it. So we find out, oops, it's still empty, even though you stopped waiting. Sorry, someone snuck in there. And we have to wait again. So questions about this scenario? So you might say, like, why is this happening? So a reason you can think about for this, why this is happening, is that when we stop waiting, when we were told to stop waiting, we weren't guaranteed to get the lock next. Someone else could get it next instead. And the pthreads design and every single monitor implementation I know of in the real world does this. There is another design, which was one of the original proposals for monitors, which doesn't do this, where instead signal, like, make sure you get the lock next. But I don't know of any real implementation of that. So if you're ever using condition variables, you're going to have to do the case where you need to check the condition again and again and again. because of this scenario, even if there were no spurious wake-ups. So that's where we're going to finish off today. So next time, we'll finish up talking about monitors and look a little at another general synchronization construct called counting semaphores.